So the title of my talk is 4D quantum gravity as a sum over histories. And I put quantum gravity in quotation mark. I notice that other people do not do that, but I had to say that I have no idea what quantum gravity is, so that's why I do it. I don't know whether we should think about this as an effective theory, as it would be in string theory, or as some kind of non-perturbative quantum field theory. You can give good arguments for, indeed very good arguments for this fact that we should only have it as an effective theory. But still there are also arguments that one could consider it as a non-perturbative quantum field theory. And here I will consider the second possibility. So this work should be understood in the general framework of asymptotic safety in order to make sense of what I'm doing here as a non-perturbative quantum field theory. I mean, we have heard other approaches, and I'm not going to have any comment on those, but I would say here that Martin Reuter tomorrow will talk about exactly asymptotic about asymptotic safety and about the normalization group realization of this program. The results there, whenever one can compare these results, are compatible with the results we obtain here, which I think is a good thing and a very exciting thing. So the main purpose here is to attribute a constructive meaning to the sum over history or the path integral. Yeah. I'm going to do this in the most simple-minded way. So everything I'm saying here is going to be absolutely trivial. But still, I hope to convince you that maybe some non-trivial results come out of this. So we are going to make sense of this functional integral in the standard way that is done in high-energy physics. So we introduce a cutoff to make sense of it, and this is a cutoff which eventually has to be taken to zero, like in a lattice. We have to divide out the diffeomorphism group, and we are going to, because what we are summing over is geometry. So the way we are going to implement this is by using building blocks. And in these building blocks, I mean, the cutoff will be contrary to what was said in the previous talks. This cutoff is going to, well, we pretend that it is a kind of diffeomorphism invariant cutoff associated with the building blocks. So what are these building blocks? Well, in one dimension, it will simply be a line element of length A. In two dimensions, it will be an equilateral triangle, again with side length A, where A is now the cutoff. And in 3D, it will be a tetrahedron, again with side length A. And in four dimensions, it will be a four simplex, again with side length A. So you use these building blocks to build your geometries. So in one dimension, this is rather trivial in the sense that, that in order to have a kind of non-trivial situation, we have to embed things in a target space. I will discuss that later. But in the higher dimensions here, we can think about this as internal space. So we build up our geometries by gluing together these building blocks. So this is what it looks in two dimensions. I have put in here a boundary. So this is geometry of a disk. And here in three dimensions, I haven't drawn very much, but it's supposed to be glued together these tetrahedrons along their triangles to form kind of three-dimensional piecewise linear manifolds. So we always imagine, for simplicity, that these building blocks are flat inside, so the geometry is trivial inside. This is nice conceptually because it makes everything kind of simple. So the point is that the piecewise linear geometry associated with such an object is uniquely determined by the gluing. Yeah, so we are really associate a geometry with these objects. It's not some kind of piecewise linear coordinate system or anything. It's a geometry associated with this. So geodesics are uniquely defined here. Angles between the geodesics are uniquely defined. So in a way, you can say that the geometry is uniquely defined. And so the way that we are providing a regularization of the path integral is that we say that the sum over all these geometries is going to be kind of replaced by the sum over the associated triangulations. So in one dimension it's trivial, in two dimensions these are the triangulations, in three dimensions we call these the triangulations, two made of tetrahedron, and in four dimensions of four simplices. And again, to each of them we have associated a cutoff here, which we eventually want to take to zero. I have here a chi-symmetry factor for the order of the automorphism group of the graph in order to get the counting right, but apart from that, it is just the sum over triangulations. So the first thing you can ask is, how does the path integral works when we use these building blocks? So I'll give you two examples very shortly in lower dimensions, in one and two dimensions, to show that at least in these dimensions, it works perfectly. So, of course, when we sum over such piecewise linear geometries, this is, of course, only a small subset of all the geometries that we should sum over in the path integral. The idea is that when we take the cutoff to zero, this set of geometries will be dense. Using the right measure, the quantum measure of geometries, it will be dense there. That is the underlying kind of assumption. In the same way as if you regularize quantum field theory on a hypercubic lattice, then of course the configuration to sum over is only a little subset of all configurations that you should sum over, but you still assume that they are dense when you take the lattice spacing to zero. And we're assuming the same thing here. So now let us take an example, which can still be formulated in terms of geometry, namely the free particle. I will use that later, so let me take it here. So we have the action, so one action one can take for the free particle. So I'm using here Euclidean connotation, but it can also be formulated in Minkowski space. This is that the action is the bare mass of the particle times the length of the path between two points, x and y. And then we know the prescription using the sum over histories, that the Green function for the particle propagating from x to y should be the sum over all paths, and the weight should be just this, using the classical action. Now, since the action only depends on the length of the path, we can split this sum up in two, namely first we sum or integrate over lengths, and then we have the action here, and then we sum over all paths going from x to y. So this is clearly just the number of paths of a given length going from x to y. So you see that in a way calculating this propagator, the free ordinary free propagator, is reduced to a pure counting problem here, namely if we can count this number of paths, then we can calculate this. In fact, you can view this as a generating function for these numbers. And this is a kind of variable which allows you to go from L to exactly to these variables. So you can view it that way if you want. So now let us count. But in order to do some intelligent counting, well, at least being simple-minded as a physicist, you have to invoke the cutoff. So we now invoke the building blocks. So here's the building block. How do I go from x to y? Well, I have to go like these piecewise linear paths here. Of course, all orientations should be done. Now, the integration over length here is now replaced by a summation over n, the number of steps here in the building blocks, and the number of building blocks in there. And this number of paths is now a cutoff dependent thing, depending on a and n. And we should now calculate this. And it can be done. I'm not going to do it for you here. I can flash it for you. But it can be done exactly in this model. And the bottom line is that after you have done this counting, and you take the lattice spacing to zero, that's very important, of course you have to take that to zero eventually, you get exactly the free propagator coming out. So here the use of building blocks acts kind of nicely. So let me now show you a slightly, well, I would not say more non-trivial example, but well, still it's kind of more non-trivial. But at least it's more in the spirit of quantum gravity. So let me consider what I call two-dimensional quantum gravity, Euclidean quantum gravity. So here there's no really quantum gravity theory because in two dimensions there's no graviton, but still you can, of course, formally implement the sum over histories. The action is just a cosmological term, and the partition function, now you can define it like Hartle-Hawking, that you have, say, some boundaries, 1, 2, 3, it's your choice. Here I've taken a situation with two boundaries, kind of like here. So you have some initial data, final data, but there's of course no real time because we're in Euclidean space here in this model at the moment. But you sum over all two geometries with these boundaries. So the diffeomorphism invariant data on the boundary is simply the length of these boundaries. So there's a length here, there's a length here, we sum all these geometries. I will now fix topology, because unfortunately I don't know how to sum all topologies. Not even in two dimensions we know how to sum all topologies. I guess that's why string theory has never been non-perturbatively defined, that we don't really know how to handle this sum all topologies, but nevertheless, let me just restrict topology here. I introduce a building block, and now it looks like this. We have a boundary here, it has a length n, the number of links here, and another boundary here, it has a number of triangles nt, and we now have to sum, and the action now has a very simple realization in terms of these. This is just a squared times the number of triangles, the length here is n, the number of links times a. So the cutoff is here too. And now you see that again this reduces to accounting problem. I write down the partition function here in terms of these discrete variables. So we are here. It depends on N1 and N2, the boundary. It depends on the cosmological constant. We have something like this. Again, we can first sum over N, the number of triangles, and, well, sorry, first sum over the triangulations with a given number of triangles, given the given boundaries, with some weight. Here it turns out that the weight is actually just one. Again, you see it's a pure counting problem. If you can calculate these numbers, in principle we have calculated the partition function. Now, this combinatorial problem can be solved. You can find these numbers. In fact, it was done long ago by a mathematician called Todde in the mid-60s. You can take the lattice spacing to zero in this, and you arrive at this expression here. So here we have the partition function for boundaries with length here, and so this is a continuum expression. Here, A has been taken to zero. I mean, for finite A, you get a complicated expression, but when you take A to zero, and you renormalize these bare cosmological constant in the right way, additive renormalization according to its dimension, then you obtain exactly this result. I have, of course, no time to go into the details here. The message I want to say to you is that this method seems to work quite well. And just to give you an idea, that it's an absolutely non-trivial calculation to do in the continuum. In fact, it was only, well, some time ago, but not that long time ago, it was completed by, and it required the genius of the Samolodnikovs and Fetev in conformal bootstrapping to actually do it. So what goes into such a continuum calculation? Well, in the continuum calculation, you have to do the usual path integral. So you have to choose a gauge first. Here I've chosen conformal gauge. So we have a conformal field. We have a kind of a digital background metric. This is kept fixed. It depends on the modular parameter of the cylinder. Then we have a gauge fixing term. We have a ghost term here. This also depends on this tau, the modular parameter. And then we have the action, the effective action coming from the quantum anomaly of the Liouville field. And it's a Liouville action here. And you have to calculate this using conformal field theory. You see, it's a kind of non-trivial conformal field theory because it involves the exponential here. This term is just the area, but in terms of phi, it's a complicated function. So it's a complicated theory. You have to solve it. You have to integrate all the modular space, and then you get the result I just mentioned to you, which you can obtain by pure counting. So this method, in the situation where we can actually test it, where we have analytical results, it seems to work kind of quite well. And one can even say that this brute force calculation is actually, in these lower dimensions, is superior to continuum calculations in many respects, even analytically. But that might be an accident of lower dimensions, I don't know. But what I want to emphasize here is that the key point here is in the context of Wilsonian path integrals, this is exactly universality, together with the sparseness of fixed points, where you can actually take a continuum limit. So if there exists a fixed point, if there exists a continuum, you can see it described in this way, then we have a good chance of finding it, even using such a simple prescription like the one I gave to you. In 4D gravity, of course, the emphasis should be on the if, because we don't know whether there are such non-trivial fixed points, because we don't know whether there is a quantum theory of gravity which can be described only in terms of ordinary field theory kind of concepts. I think kind of Martin will tell he will tell a lot about this. He will tell a lot about this tomorrow. Here, I will just in this specific context, I will kind of provide some evidence that at fixed point it could actually exist, because we get some results which seems to be kind of interesting, indicating that a continuum limit exists. Now, when we go to dimensions larger than or equal to 3, we have to invoke the Einstein-Hilbert term. And here again, the use of piecewise linear geometry is nice, because the Einstein-Hilbert action has a natural kind of geometric interpretation exactly when we use piecewise linear geometry. This is called the Ratty action. I'm not going to describe it for you. If you don't know it, then you just have to believe me, and else, of course, it's kind of trivial what I say. What I want to say here is so that if we use identical desimplices, then the Ratty action becomes exceedingly simple. In fact, here I write it down in four dimensions. It can just be written as the number of triangles in the triangulation, in the four-dimensional triangulation, times a constant K2. So this is the bare coupling constant. In fact, it is the bare gravitational coupling constant is inversely proportional to this, and K4 times the number of forced impulses. And this K4 is kind of related to the cosmological constant. It's not proportional to it, it's kind of simplified, but we can think about it as this, as just being kind of proportional to it. But it's kind of related to it in a simple way. So, this means that the four-dimensional partition function for quantum gravity becomes exceedingly simple. It's the sum of our triangulations here, and now again, because of this simple action, you can write it as some factor here, only depending on N2 and N4, and then the sum of all four-dimensional triangulations consisting of four simplices with a given number of four simplices and triangles here. So we just have to count this number, and it's a pure counting problem. And again, you can view this partition function as a generating function for precisely these numbers. Now, so entirely combinatorial. Well, you can ask whether, can it really be so simple? Well, we don't know, of course. But I hope that these examples, in particular the case from kind of two-dimensional quantum gravity, says that, well, maybe this approach is capable of producing complicated results from a very simple input. But there's a kind of stumbling block when we go to higher dimensions. So I should mention that. So you would think naively that using d-dimensional building blocks and just construct something, you would build a d-dimensional universe. I mean, you imagine the toddler you put on the floor, and she or he is putting together the Lego blocks. And if they are three-dimensional, of course, this person will create a three-dimensional kind of geometry. Not true, at least not in any naive sense. In fact, one can say that the result of inattentive construction work is that you will always, with probability 1, you will create a universe of cutoff scale, simply because of entropy. So by cutoff scale, I mean here again, basically the size of the building blocks. So kind of no matter how many of these building blocks you put together and staple on top of each other, you keep the topology fixed, not to complicate matter, it still takes, after you completed this, it will only take a few steps to be able to go from any one building block to any other building block. That's, of course, very counterintuitive for our building in three dimensions, but that's because we are embedded in three dimensions when we build it. So there are certain restrictions to our building, our construction, which is essential for our intuition, and which is not true if you just abstractly kind of glue these together. So the typical universe you obtain by constructively is of cutoff scale, which is not so good, maybe. Well, a priori it's not a problem, but it seems bad, and it is bad if you want to get something which resembles our universe, in fact. But of course you could say, aha, let us pay special attention to our construction work. Let us put in a weight for each geometry we build. And, well, let's take this weight. Huh? It's not a bad way to take the Einstein-Hilbert action in there. So what happens? If the bare gravitational coupling constant is large, that means 1 over g is small, then this term plays no real role, and we still see what I just described to you. But then when we kind of decrease this, at a certain point, there is a transition. And suddenly, I mean, the universe that you build will change from being of no extension to be maximally extended. We call these branch polymers. So, and these branch polymers, this is another class of geometries which are really independent of the dimension of the building block. So in any dimensions higher than 3, it seems that you will get something like this for when the gravitation coupling constant is the bare gravitation coupling constant, not the renormalized one, but the bare one is small. So we have two situations where what we get is seemingly independent of the dimension of the building blocks. So historically, you can call this Euclidean quantum gravity because we are using here the Eisenhower-Hilbert action with the Euclidean signature here. So there is a phase transition between the crumpled phase and the extended phase. So originally we were very excited about this because it seems to indicate that right at this point there is a phase transition and we should define our continuum four-dimensional theory exactly at the intersection there. Since anyway 4 is kind of the average between infinity and 2 here, so it seems kind of not a bad choice. And a lot of work was done there, but unfortunately it turns out in the end that this transition, it was not a second order transition where you have a smooth going from one to another. It was a first order transition. There was a discontinuous jump, so either you were in one phase or you were in another phase. And we have found no natural way to avoid this. There might be one. It would still be very nice, but that's what not. So, well, since I mentioned the string theorist, I should also mention that even in two dimensions, these branch polymers, they play a role, actually. So if you want to formulate the kind of non-perturbative string theory in the sense that you want really to define what you mean by string theory in terms of a functional integral where you sum over configurations with positive weight and the area of the surface and so on, in target space, then you find that when the dimension of this target space is larger than 2, it is impossible. In fact, you get branch polymers will totally dominate the thing, and you have kind of nothing, kind of like a string theory. And what it shows to you is that the bosonic string, because we are discussing the bosonic string here, that the bosonic string theory is tachyonic. So whenever they do analytic kind of calculations with the bosonic string theory, it can never be described by a kind of healthy statistical theory like this, where every weight is put in to be positive. Some analytic continuation has to go on. So you can say that these branch polymers, they are the well-regulated, healthy, series version of the tachyon. That you see, they want to go out, really propagate out to infinity, kind of faster than really allowed. So we were kind of stuck here with the higher dimensional kind of quantum gravity, and we needed some general principle to change it. So this is what we call causal dynamical triangulations. And we used, it was inspired by various works. It was inspired by work by Teitelbaum from the early 80s, and it was inspired by work by Sorkin about causal sets, and by Fuccini and Lee also about these causal sets. Maybe our approach I will describe now is kind of closest to the ideas of Teitelbaum at that time. So what he said was, I'm not sure he mean it still, but nevertheless he said it at that time, even in print, in order to have a causal theory, it seems unbelievable for him that you should allow, if you choose proper time and some propagation here, that you should allow some kind of branching out like this. You should really allow a global time foliation in terms of, say, proper time, for instance. So here, clearly, there is a split up. The light cone is degenerate at this point if time goes in this direction. And, well, in my own mental thing, coming a little bit from string theory, I feel that if you allow such a split up, you should also allow the kind of rejoining. And then, clearly, you are creating closed time-like loops and so on. And it's maybe very hard to imagine that you, on the world sheet here, could have some emerging causal theory. Well, it's not ruled out, but it's hard to imagine. But so So it's clear that this constraint here is not a topological constraint. So it only exists as a guiding line for what to allow if we work in a Lorentzian signature. This was also emphasized by Teitelbaum at that time. But it will clearly disallow a certain number of outgrowths like this, which you saw was a great problem if you just did the Euclidean path integral. So what we have been trying to do in coarse dynamical calculations is to implement this in a kind of geometrical way and a concrete way to perform the path integral there. So basically we imagine that we have a slicing of space. So it's pictured here. In the four-dimensional case, we have a slicing of space. You can call this time, but we only work with geometry. So this is a kind of proper distance between these two spatial slices here. And so we have any three-dimensional triangulation here of a fixed topology, say S3 for simplicity. And we have the same thing here, also with S3. And then we turn this into a kind of four-dimensional kind of Lorentzian geometry, which has a causal structure between these two with a definite light cone by connecting points here to tetrahedra here, by links here to triangles here, by triangles here to links here, and by tetrahedra here to points here. And in kind of such a way that the total topology will be that of the interval kind of cross S3. And now for each, so we are summing, so in the path integral we have such a discrete kind of slicing space hypersurfaces. You can think about it like this, but it's of course in terms of geometry. And so we have a number of these, and we then sum over all possible configurations, all possible S3 triangulations here, and all possible ways to connect them, such that the topology is precisely what I said. And now for each such configuration, it is possible, if we want to, and we want to, for practical reasons, it's possible to perform an analytic continuation from the time-like links which connect these two spatial hypersurfaces to Euclidean. So in principle now we have broken the symmetry between space and time, you can say, in the sense that these links, they don't need to have the same length. So we can just take them to be proportional. So they're related like this. But now we can make an analytic continuation of alpha to minus alpha in the lower complex plane. And in this way, the Lorentzian Ratje action goes over exactly into I times the Euclidean Ratje action as it should do, kind of naively. So basically what we are doing now is the following. So we start out with our path integral here. Oops. So we start out with our path integral, our continuum path integral in Lorentzian signature. We now provide a regularization of this by introducing a diffeomorphism invariant cutoff, summing over triangulations, and we restrict these triangulations to be the class of triangulations that I just mentioned. Now, for calculation purpose, we can rotate these to Euclidean space, and we can perform the sum there. And we keep the four volume is related, the continuum four volume will be related to the number of four simplices and the lattice spacing in this way here. Well, in principle here, we had two lattice spacings, AS and AT, but for simplicity, let me just write it like this. So, unfortunately, we do not have the analytical power of the lower dimensions where we could actually do the explicit calculations. So here we are relying on computer simulations. So for technical reasons, we will usually do the computer simulations. We'll perform them when N4 is fixed, which is not maximally physical, but we'll have to live with that. So our setup is the following. We have again our partition function. The boundary data is a fixed three geometry. At the top, a fixed three geometry. At the bottom, so we characterize this in diffeomorphism invariant terms by saying that this upper boundary has a fixed geodesic distance to the lower one. So we are now in Euclidean space, so we just talk about one distance. So it has a fixed kind of distance to this. So every point here has a fixed distance to here. And there is now a slicing, a foliation, you can say, of the geometries, kind of like this. So for any time here, it's of course discretized, but for any time here, we have a three volume. We can integrate to find the three volume of this. We put this into the computer, and we see what do we get out. Well, I will present some options for you here, in order that you better can appreciate what we see, actually. Well, so here is the situation. You see nothing here. This is just a cutoff scale, and the whole universe is kind of located at exactly one time. Well, pretty perverse. Here's another perverse situation. Actually, almost nothing happens. If you make this time larger, well, then just this will, if the volume, four volume is fixed, then this will just shrink, such that the product of the time times the three volume is constant. Or you have a long number of kind of disconnected three kind of universes like this, which basically do not talk to each other. Here we have again the cutoff scale. So these are, you would say, kind of pathological situations, which you'd hope not to see. Well, I tell you, we have seen all of them. All of them have we seen. It depends on the choice of coupling constants. I don't have time to go into a detailed discussion, but there is a range of coupling constants where we see something more interesting. So you have to remember that this is a kind of regularized theory, and there's no obvious reason that there should be a continuum limit of this theory. And as I told you for the Euclidean thing, it was impossible to find anything which kind of resembled what we would like to be kind of continuum. But here, with the restriction enforced to us by causality or whatever you would like to call it, we see something interesting. Unfortunately, you cannot see it whole. So time is up. So you see here a universe which starts, and what I plot here is space. So space is in this direction, and time is here. So you see, well, let me start up since I cannot show the whole figure here. You start with a universe of no extension, spatial extension. Nothing happens. And then suddenly a universe starts to be created, and it will disappear again. Well, you have to remember that the four volume is fixed here, so it has to disappear again eventually because this, if time is sufficiently long, and this, but you see, from what I've said, there's absolutely no reason that there should be any relation between the extension here of this direction, which is time direction, and the spatial volumes. In fact, there are many situations where this is cannot happening. So the first thing we asked ourselves of when we saw such a blob here was, how is the time direction kind of related to the spatial direction? Is this a genuine four-dimensional object or not? And, the way that a solid-state physicist, or maybe even a high-energy physicist, would approach this was that he would measure some correlators and discuss their scaling relation. So this is exactly what we did. So we measured the correlation between three volumes at kind of different times. I still call them time in quotation marks, but these are different geodesic distances. So we integrate by translation invariance. We integrate all these and divide by the total time, and we normalized these correlators in this way. So this is just technicalities. So precisely what do you see when after this normalization? What you see is that when the universe is large, when there are many four simplices, then you see a broad distribution of this correlation. When there are few, then you see a very small one. Now, what fixes the dimension of time, kind of relative to four volume, is the following. If you can find a scaled variable here, so you kind of rescale this variable in this way here with some coefficient alpha, such that all these curves can be put on top of these, then this is exactly an expression of the fact that the time has the dimension, spatial dimension, V4 to alpha. And that it's the same physics that you see, except for the fact that the volume is different. Now, what we find is alpha equal to 1/4. So it shows exactly that time is canonical. And in fact, this overlap is perfect. I will show it to you here. So here is the correlation function as measured on the computer. The average over many, many configurations, you obtain beautiful curves which align just on top of each other if you take alpha equal to 1/4. Of course, we can even estimate some error bars, so we get alpha equal to 1/4 plus minus 0.002. Of course, changing alpha a little bit will also give a good approximation. So it is based on 5 curves, 5 different volumes, 22,000, 45,000, 91,000, 181,000, and 300,000 4 simplices. And they just fit perfectly. So the conclusion from this, it is that our space is indeed 4-dimensional. But then, of course, we got kind of curious, because now we have this nice correlation function. So is it possible to describe this correlation function by an effective action? So you see here, we have really integrated. So in principle here, all degrees of freedom, if this was a zero quantum gravity, which of course we do not know, but if it was a zero quantum gravity, we are really integrating out all degrees of freedom except for one, namely the free volume, also called the scale factor, if you write V of 3 as A cube. So what we did was that we said, okay, now since we have this nice computer, we can really take a experimental approach to this. We simply measure the probability distribution of neighboring three volumes. And what we found was that it is very well described by the following formula. Yeah. That the probability distribution is given in this formula. Here's the three volume of time t plus 1 times t divided by this times some constants here. So if this was true, then the effective action is, of course, just the product of these probability distributions. So the effective action will just be this thing here, integrated over t. I put in here a Lagrange multiplier called lambda in order to implement that the 4 volume is kept fixed. And now by introducing not the 3 volume, but the scale factor, then this action, after rescaling a and t, can be written in this form here. And you see that this is exactly the mini-superspace action for homogeneous isotropic universes, which you get by starting out with a metric like this and just keeping 1 degree of freedom, namely A. But here it has been derived completely opposite. It has been derived by keeping all degrees of freedom, integrating them out except for A, and we arrive at this expression. And I can tell you that we really derived at it because, dumb as I was the main contributor, I didn't like this A 1/3 here. I thought that was stupid. And it was only after introducing A that we saw that it was exactly right. It should be there. So it was really a kind of derivation. We didn't know exactly what to expect. We got this result here. So now, once we have this mini superspace, I can repeat the words. So this is not my words now, but the words of Hartle, Hawking, Wilenkin, other people who have been working with these mini superspace models. So now we have this mini superspace model. We have a corresponding potential. So I plotted it here. V of A, it looks like this. Now, this blob that we saw, what exactly was this blob? Well, now you see what it happens. You start out here. You can stay here for a long, long time because the potential is flat. But you give it a little push here, and then you roll down here, you get to maximum A, and you roll back again. This is exactly what we saw. We stay here for a long, long time, that's the stalk. Then we expand here. This is here, maximum A. Then we go back again, we roll down again. This is our blob. This is exactly what we saw. So what we have observed in the computer is a perfect example of a bounce. And not only is it a perfect example of a bounce, if we go back and we take this effective action and we create some artificial data, they are lying right at the top of the ones we actually measured. So it gives a perfect description of what it was. So our model has indeed managed to reproduce from, I would say, first principles, precisely the mini superspace model that people have been playing around with. Now, this is also not my words, so I'll just repeat, but the interpretation that people have been giving to this. So we have now our Euclidean potential, because we were in Euclidean space. It is here. How do we go from Euclidean quantum mechanics to Lorentzian quantum mechanics? Well, we turn the potential around. That's the standard prescription. I go into IT. That's how we go from here to here. And that turns around the potential, or the kinetic term, depending on what you like. And a bounce, the bounce action is turned into a WKB tunneling. So the interpretation is the following. So here you have the bounce. There's a factor of 1/2, because we are only considering half of the bounce. We go from here to here. So that's half of the bounce action, which is there. And that's exactly the amplitude for tunneling from this situation to here. So, in particular, Velinkin has been, of course, talking very much about this, that you have a universe of no extension, and then you tunnel, go through this region and come out here at some kind of macroscopic size, and then after that it rolls down and become an ordinary de Sitter space. So that is his kind of universe from nothing. Well, basically that's what we see here. Of course, what that we see this is, of course, partially a function of our setup. Well, I would like to present you one more graph now. So after we saw this perfect match between the effective action and I'm sorry for the quality of this because it's a little bit washed out here. But then we went back to the blob. So let me just flash the blob for you again, just so you can recall how what it looks. Maybe if I turn it like this, it's better. So we have this blob here. Time is here. And this is these are the three volumes, the kind of circumference here. Now, what you see here is a snapshot of the configuration from the computer. So this is a configuration, of course, a two-dimensional projection of it. It's a configuration of the path integral. Well, in my old school child learning, it doesn't mean anything. I mean, this is not a physical thing. We cannot, well, I know that Raphael Sorkin is trying to promote this as something else, but let us stay conservative here and say that it has absolutely no meaning as such. We cannot measure the path of a particle, so it's not an observable in quantum gravity. It's only used as a representation in the path integral. So this individual configuration has no meaning, of course. But average values of certain observables can have a meaning. Like average volume of the free volume can have a definite meaning. So we try to go back and actually kind of measure the shape of this. And this is much more difficult than measuring the correlators, because the correlators, they use in an optimal way the kind of statistics available. You have to remember, so what, on the computer we see a configuration like this, then we iterate many, many times, then we see another configuration, the shape is different, the location of the center is moved, and so on. So it's difficult to compare these, but you can, of course, kind of define a center of mass here, and you can superimpose all these, and if you take a couple of 100,000, close to 1,000,000 of these configurations, you superimpose them, and you should remember that these are generated by many, many, many updates of the computer also, so between each independent configuration goes thousands of sweeps also to create. So a lot of computer time goes into this, but we still did it because we were curious to see how would the shape be of this average kind of universe. I'm sorry? Absolutely, we're always staying in Euclidean. This is the bounce, this is the block, yeah, absolutely. So precisely what did we see? What you see here, so error bars are here, because these are fluctuating, but the curve here is sine cube. So it's a perfect match to sine cube. Well, sine cube is, of course, you look at the three volume, so sine cube is the projection from S4. So what we see here is S4. So it just says that this blob is perfectly S4. Now you might recall that S4 is the solution to the kind of de Sitter equations. So what we see is the semi-classical de Sitter universe imposed by quantum fluctuations. coming out of this. And I recall to you that nothing went into this. The action was absolutely trivial. Nothing. It was a radiaction, but it was absolutely trivial. It was entirely just a number of four simplices and number of triangles and so on. So it's really coming from the quantum fluctuation. So they organize themselves exactly such that the semi-classical solution, a classical solution superimposed by quantum fluctuation. So we decided also to look a little bit into the geometry of the slices. So now we have seen that the universe is perfectly described by S4. Now we had imposed, of course, that the topology of the spatial slices should be S3. That was imposed for us, but it doesn't mean that it will look something like S3. Only that the topology should be like that. So the first very simple question we asked was, is this space really three-dimensional? Because it is also, from what I said to you, it is highly non-trivial, because at these slices here, we can have any triangulations whatsoever. And if you just put them in arbitrarily without paying any attention to them, then what you would get was a universe of no extension. Even in three dimensions, you would get that. So now we are asking, but now, of course, we have a specific action here, the four-dimensional action, and we have this constraint that there should be a time foliation. So it restricts the possible classes of geometries that we can get. And for this choice of coupling constants, what we see here is the logarithm of the free volume of a slice, and the logarithm of the average radius of this. And you see that they lie on a straight line, corresponding to the fact that V goes as R to the cube. So they are really three-dimensional, kind of contrary to the typical configuration that you would get with simply coming from entropy. So at least they are three-dimensional, these objects. So we now asked, like, the four-dimensional thing was really S4, beautifully. So are these guys also S3? And they are almost S3s. So here's a measurement. You can hardly see this thing, unfortunately, because, again, you cannot really focus this thing. I can hold it like this, but that's a little bit unfortunate. Well, anyway, so here's various cuts of the three volume. I'm not going into the discussion, but you see, the curve here is S3. So for small radius, they follow very nicely. So this is plotting basically the volume. If you go out geodesic distance R, and then you take the volume enclosed in a ball of this geodesic radius, it will be something. If it was a three sphere for small radius, it would go as for a three sphere, it would then go as sine squared of R when we work our way out, and you see that it does that very well, even on the other side of the sine squared when it goes down here. For the very largest distances, there is clearly some effects here, but it's very close to being S3. Yeah. So we conclude that certain large distance effect of this geometry is indeed this is indeed very kind of three-dimensional. So large-scale aspects of this seems to be nice. Some kind of classical Euclidean universe superimposed with quantum fluctuations. Now, how can we see some quantum phenomena here? And it cannot just classical. So the quantum phenomena should clearly come from the fluctuations. And one way to measure this is to kind of use diffusion. So you can say that what we did before was that we were using kind of rods. Well, we are in Euclidean, so there are no clocks. We were using rods to measure distances out and forming three spheres and so on. Alternatively, you can use kind of light rays to communicate, which would be, in this version, the kind of diffusion. So this is the heat kernel of a scalar particle. And on a given geometry, you have a diffusion equation like this. In flat space, we have this solution here to the diffusion equation, which is well known. Now we don't want to go into discussion of these x's, because they are coordinates. So we don't want to touch these, because we have no meaning of these if we only speak about geometries. However, if you look at the return probability, take the same x, you see that in flat space, it will go like this. In curved space, you can calculate it, and its short distance part is like this, And then you will have corrections which depend on the curvature of the geometry and so on. All this is well known from the heat kernel expansions. If you integrate this over all x's with the square root of g, I mean, what you get is a concept of return probability, which is invariant diffeomorphism. So it is actually, it qualifies as a good quantum observable in the sense that it is diffeomorphism invariant, and we can, on the computer, we can take the average of this. So we measured this, and the dimension D here is called the spectral dimension, because you can even study this diffusion process on structures which are not smooth manifolds, but are fractal, and then you can get these, which are kind of different from kind of integer values. So what do we see on the computer? Well, here's a measurement of the spectral dimension. As a function of this sigma here should be the tau from before. And these curves are the error bars involved in this dimension. So you see that we have a curve here telling you that when we go to large, relatively large distance, it goes nicely to 4. But for small distances, it's smaller. In fact, this curve can be fitted very nicely, in fact perfectly, by the following function here. Showed it to here. That it's, instead of this, we have 2 and then times this correct. So you see that for large tau, you get 2 given d equal to 4. For small distances, you get 2. You get just 1 over tau. That is d equal to 2. So I put in here a g. So what is this g? Well, I would like very much that this is a renormalized gravitational coupling constant of our theory. Because then this would tell us that for tau much larger than this g, in fact, what we see is four-dimensional space, but we have the diffusion process for small distances, then we see effectively a fractal space. It's two-dimensional, but, I mean, you should be aware that spectral dimensions and Hausdorff dimensions and so on, they're a very rough measure for what is actually going on. So it just shows to you that space is kind of fractal. It doesn't tell you that it's nice two-dimensional or anything like that. That is fractal in some specific way, giving a spectral dimension too. We are still working on giving a proof that this G can be viewed as a renormalized G we have no proof of that right now. It's certainly not the bare gravitational coupling constant, and it shouldn't be the bare gravitational coupling constant. And I should say that this is exactly what you also get, maybe Martin will tell about it tomorrow, that you get the same picture coming from Kayusi normalization group approaching a non-trivial fixed point. So that's quite exciting. Now, the last topic I will cover here this is the inclusion of matter fields. So this is a nice topic. It's, of course, in principle, if you just talk about... I'll finish in a couple of minutes. So if we just talk about the scalar fields, of course, we know from the continuum that it's very easy to couple them to gravity. We just do like this. We can do it more complicated, but just do it like this. Now, this kinetic term is very easily described in our formalism. Here in two dimensions, we have equilateral triangles. We put the fields in the middle of the triangles, and then the derivative is just this difference, because the distance here is, by construction, the same. So we have done these simulations. And of course, if you just look at kind of geometric properties, we are effectively integrating out the scalar field. And we know already from the continuum what to expect, namely that we get gravity including higher order r's. What we have seen is that this blob still exists. So a four-dimensional universe is somehow formed for a large class basically for these scalar fields. We put a coupling constant in front of them, and for a large class of these coupling constants. We haven't looked at the real details of this. So I cannot say anything more than it's a good sign, because it shows that this is robust compared to changing the whatever underlying continuum Lagrangian one should use close to the fixed point. You can study the inverse problem. The inverse problem is interesting, because that would be the study the influence of fluctuating geometry on the scalar propagation. But it's a complicated thing, because it means that we have to define propagation in fluctuating geometries. We should define what is distance in fluctuating geometries. This can be done. And unfortunately, I had no time to talk about it. It is one of my pet topics. And I should say that 2D is a beautiful lab for this, because the conceptual problems in 2D gravity is, of course, the same in terms of diffeomorphism and variant distance when you integrate over geometries, etc. It can be done there, and everything works extremely nicely with these diffeomorphism invariant definitions, which can be given. But I have no time to talk about this here. So I will talk about something which is simpler. Just 1 minute. Let us put in, I mean, the former speakers, they had a long leverage, I would say. So let me also get a little bit. We cut down on the discussion section. Let me recall the calculation, the nice calculation of Bodenese. We have Einstein-Hilbert action. We put in test particles, and we now calculate our functional integral. Kind of like this. Just a quadratic order. We know that when t goes to infinity, it should go to the ground state energy of this system. And he found a very nice result, namely to lowest order, we get exactly the Newton's law when r is large. But this was perturbative. This was done around flat space. Now we have a truly background-independent, non-perturbative definition. So what the hell is r here? Is it the geodesic distance? What is p1 and p2? The geometries are fluctuating all the time. I mean, what do we mean by a fixed path here? And, of course, Kanner Bodenese addressed this in his article and kind of realized that it was a difficult question. And because of that, I think he didn't say too much about it in the end. And, well, we know how to implement it, but I have no time to talk about that. So I will just mention a similar approach. Just take one particle, a massive particle, include it as a real quantum particle. So integrate over the matrix, integrate over the path, exactly as I told you for the free particle. This is a perfect description of a scalar particle here. For large m, we would expect it to have a path which is basically localized. And we see that on the computer. This is exactly what happens. So this mass is a gravitational source. It should deform the geometry around it. So we can do these calculations. We have done them. And I had some very exciting results to tell you, but unfortunately we found an error in the computer code just 3 days before coming here. So I don't dare to tell you about these results. Hopefully they're right, but I don't have to tell you about them. So I would rather mention something to you, which shows what is nice about these computers. What is ugly is, of course, that this is numerical and not analytical. What is nice is that you are forced to think about these conceptual problems in a very simple-minded way. So now suppose that we have this measurement, we see a deformed geometry. Exactly to what should we compare it to? Can recall that we are in Euclidean space, and let me just assume asymptotic flatness. We have a metric like this, for instance, in some coordinate system. But contrary to in Mikoskian space, r equal to the Schwarzschild radius, this is a regular point where the geometry stops. I mean, there's no interior here. But in our computer, of course, we have an interior. We have put in the particle. So we are clearly totally incompatible with this. So we are creating a quantum situation which has no classical kind of analogy. And it's an interesting point. How should we compare this? So, Chairman, I will summarize now and shut up. A summary here. So we have an absolute minimalistic model here, which seems to provide a picture of large-scale background geometry compatible with isotropy and homogeneity. And moreover, we actually observe a perfect S4 and Euclidean bounds here. So around this, we have quantum fluctuations. At small distances, these fluctuations, they dominate, and we observe non-classical features like a spectral dimension of 2. We can include matter fields without any problem. And if you take a free scalar particle and include it, it will really behave like a classical particle with quantum deformations. And around the position of this particle, we see deformation of the geometry. We have not quantified this yet. We are in the process of doing that, so unfortunately I cannot really report on it. But that is the present status. I consider this very promising. Of course, we would still like to see clearly that gravity, if it is gravity we have defined, because I don't know, gravity attracts, and Newton's law would be nice to verify at long distances, and we would like to see gravitons. Now, these things, again, I remind you that this is really background-independent approach, so it's not so easy to measure gravitons. What do you mean by gravitons being a given distance? Well, we can define this for scalar particles. I don't know in this formalism how to define spin-2 particles in a simple way. But if somebody of you have any ideas, it would be very nice. Then we can implement it on a computer and indeed go and measure it. Thank you very much for your patience.
Just a presentation that I'm trying to make. Somebody has a microphone? I don't have it.
I have a question which is actually contained in one sentence. There are three parts to it. Let's not waste time to go back to that slide, but that was the slide where you would like to get the four dimensional space time, and you mentioned that you look at the time-time slice interaction, as well as cross-grading, or you put an integrated number of variables, and only before you actually get the equation, which looks like the Einstein equation, but with the box in it, right? So I have the three questions, the three parts of my question is, the first is that with these synthesis and the rules that you allow it to sort of grow, isn't that sort of a memory dependent process among Markovian? It doesn't depend just on the previous slice, but does it depend on all that came actually before it? It is just a simple slicing.
Yeah.
Okay, so when you say time-time interaction or time-size interaction, wouldn't that generate some memory?
Well, as far as we can see, it only generate memories in the same sense as closest neighbor interactions create memories.
Okay. The second part of the question is that when you integrate all the variables, you get this nice result, right? Is there some, there must be some constraining of some irrelevant degrees of freedom along the way, is that correct?
Well, that's right, in the sense that you can say that we integrate out everything except the three volume. So of course, the three volume is a derived concept obtained by integrating over but everything else is integrated out.
So the last part of this one sentence that you wrote down, and my question is that you actually get the Einstein equation from doing these things, is that right?
Yes, but I wouldn't call it the Einstein equation. It's only the part of the equation involving the scale factor. But no transverse degrees of freedom are really invoked here.
Yeah, that's okay. You're being honest.
I'm being realistic, I would say.
What I'm trying to get at is that from this simplicity or rather minimal type of procedure or instruction or algorithm, you can actually see the Einstein's equation of the Euclidean version of that, which enable you to claim that there's a bias in there, something like that. Is that?
If you still would call it the Einstein action, I would say yes, but I wouldn't call it the Einstein action. I would just call it the effective action for the scale factor. And that effective action happens to agree completely with the Einstein, the mini superspace action. But also, that is not the Einstein action. It's So for the scale factor, it seems to be right. Yes.
Yeah. Raphael.
I guess you might call it freedom equation, which is just one of the short word. So this is a question of the relationship to the asymptotic freedom idea, which you indicated this is going to be consistent with maybe some evidence in favor of. As I recall, in that approach, one normally expected a non-trivial fixed point.
Yeah.
And you would expect it to see in the action, in the variation, you expect it to see a large, maybe infinite number of different terms. And what you've done here, I think you kept all the proofs for zero. So is that a surprise, or how do you react to that observation?
Yeah, well, I think it's not a surprise. I mean, of course, we do not, strictly speaking, know how to convert this equation into a continuum equation. But in the effective theory, I mean, if you want to follow the randomization group approach, in general, you expect that to be some complicated Lagrangian, which doesn't have maybe a simple expression in terms of metrics. But if you truncate it and just consider the Einstein action, then you still get this fixed point. You still reach this fixed point in this truncated coupling constant space. So in a certain way, you can say that you can imagine that we are operating in this truncated coupling constant space. But rather, I would say something different. I mean, what we are using is this simple kind of Ratty action. But this simple Ratty action doesn't necessarily have a continuum simple translation. I mean, it has such a translation. If you have a smooth geometry and you provide a suitable triangulation of this smooth geometry, then, of course, by definition almost, I mean the Ratty action will go into the continuum Einstein action. But that's not how we're applying it here. We are taking these geometries, these piecewise linear geometries, they are just built of these building blocks. And the curvature is discrete, and none of these configurations has any continuum limit in general. So you should view them as just points scattered in the space of geometries, piecewise linear geometries. So the translation is not so kind of direct, unfortunately. And that's also why I was careful phrasing that we have agreement kind of whenever we can compare the results like the spectral dimension. But so it's more a moral thing. I mean, this approach doesn't make sense unless there is some kind of relatively stable fixed point with only a few kind of irrelevant directions, which you can approach kind of relatively easily. So you should be able to approach it in many different ways. And so you approach the critical surface where you have the same continuum theory in the Wilsonian sense.
I'm not sure I understood the answer fully, but
yeah, well,
you don't normally have to tune a large number of parameters, so I still feel like there's something surprising that came out so nicely. It's true that the action that you use can't be directly translated into the continuum, so maybe I should call the Einstein number of action. But it's inspired by this.
Well,
yeah, and it only has two or three parameters.
It's not surprising if there exists a hypersurface in the sense of Weinberg with finite codimensions, so only a finite number of kind of relevant directions. Then it's not surprising. What is surprising is maybe that there exists such a fixed point or such a critical surface at all. You could wonder whether that's the case because you haven't seen it too much in ordinary field theory, such a critical surface.
So you're saying you could try various other things and
yeah, I
would.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying. Exactly.
Last question.
I was wondering whether it's possible from your numerical simulations to get results on the entropy of the cosmological relation.
No.
Because you consider fluctuations around your geometry, associated with those.
Yeah, but you have to define it for me, even in quantum field theory, precisely what is the entropy. I mean, in quantum field theory, you can usually not define the entropy. It's always infinite.
But
this discreteness is, of course, I should emphasize this, there is no discreteness here. This is just a kind of auxiliary cutoff which you take to zero. And you would expect to get ordinary, well, this is in the context of ordinary quantum field theory. And I think nobody there knows how to define entropy as such.
Mm-hmm.